Hello and welcome to another episode of Shadow Talk, your weekly cybersecurity news and threat research podcast that's brought to you by ReliaQuest. My name is Chris and I'm delighted to be your host. This week I'm joined by two of my colleagues. So first up, we have podcast veteran Kim Bromley on the line. How are you doing, Kim? You okay?
Hello. Yes, I'm good. Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
And we also have Fergal Hughes jumping back on the podcast. Is this your third episode, Fergal?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, third.
Good. Awesome. Well, thanks for joining. We have an interesting episode ahead today. So the first topic we're going to be covering this week is related to a vulnerability affecting a pretty common IT software provider, ConnectWise, which originally when this vulnerability came out, it was claimed that this wasn't being actively exploited, but unfortunately that's taken an unwanted turn for the worse, with lots of different threat groups being attributed to active exploitation of this particular bug. So Fergal, I know you've been looking into this one. Could you provide listeners with an overview of this bug? You know, what can it lead to, et cetera?
Absolutely. So on February 19th, there were two vulnerabilities for the ConnectWise remote desktop software product known as Screen Connect that were announced as patched. These vulnerabilities were CVE 2024-1708 and 1709, and they were given the alias or aliases slash and grab. 2 days later, the vulnerabilities were reported as being exploited in the wild after concept code emerged online. Multiple ones across multiple platforms, loads of different ways to exploit them. The latter vulnerability as well, so 1709, is particularly exploitable. It has a CVSS of 10, which is top marks in the vulnerability scoring system, and it's an authentication bypass vulnerability, meaning that attackers have absolute backdoor entry to any critical system and any information as well, if exploited. The amount of exposed vulnerable servers as well in the time since this has happened has decreased by over half since the proof of concepts were released. But the patching has been very slow in general, and it would appear that there are still some servers left. But by and large, yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't sound good. And you know it's a big deal when it gets a name, right? What was the name you had
slash,
there?
Slash and grab. Yeah, so, you know, slash and grab, yeah. So a particularly nasty one, which is reflective of the insidious kind of nature of the attacks.
Connotation of the name. Yeah. I like it. Well, if they get a name and a logo, you know it's bad, right? What's the kind of scale of this issue? What's the general sort of scale and risk?
We've seen a hive of exploit activity for this. So first of the party was Lockbit, who are continuing to claim attacks all the while being taken down by the authorities. And we also saw the deployment of malware like Xworm and Cobalt Strike and all the rest of it. AlphaB were also able to exploit the vulnerability to target hospitals in the US. And as of yesterday, so that's the 5th of March, Kimsuki exploited these flaws as well to deploy a new backdoor called Toddler Shark. It remains to be seen if there's going to be any more threat actors jumping on the proverbial bandwagon.
So it's a combination of nation state aligned threats and cyber criminality going after these flaws.
Yeah, so it started off being just a ransomware thing, and now it seems to be a nation state one. So it's kind of open to all at this point.
Okay. What should listeners do? You know, other than the obvious, patch it as soon as possible. We know that's the first thing you should be doing, but as we know with vulnerability management, it can often, it's not as simple as that. There's also kinds of roadblocks that can be in the way, stopping people from patching in a timely manner. But is there any other advice we can give?
Yeah, so aside from the obvious, remote access software like Screen Connect is a really great target for threat actors. And it's always good practice to shield web interfaces for these tools, like behind firewalls. In the time as well that I've seen this happen from start to finish, there's also been released loads of intrusion detection rules. So if you want to be extra secure, go out and find those and implement them if you want to. It's also worth noting that there's plenty of intrusion detection rules out there as well if you want to be extra secure.
Good stuff. Well, there you go, folks. That's what you need to do. Awesome. Let's move on to the second topic of the day. That surrounds our latest spotlight report, deep diving into a trending attack we've seen with regularity, and that's on browser credential dumping. So, Kim, could you provide listeners with an overview of the report's content and what we identified?
Sure. The report discusses how threat actors are switching to more sophisticated methods for obtaining access to valid accounts. So we're seeing them move away from using brute force techniques and over to things like browser credential dumping. And we think that this is because of the increasing sophistications that many organizations are adopting when it comes to their auditing. So that means threat actors are having to find more sophisticated ways to avoid detection, to carry out their bad means of attacks. So within the report, we examine how attackers are performing browser credential dumping. So that's them stealing credentials stored in browsers or session cookies for anybody that doesn't know. And that typically happens after an attacker has already achieved initial access to a target network. So what the report outlines is that this is a risk to all organizations everywhere. If you've got users that are storing credentials in their browsers or even just browsing the internet, then this is a risk to you. And the report goes through like the different operating systems that this can be performed on and the different tools that can be used. Notably in the report, we see that browser credential dumping has accounted for 21% of all the credential access techniques that we observed across our customer base in 2023. And also that multiple threat groups are using these tools and techniques. So we've got Lapsus Group using the Redline Info Stealer, Quackbot can dump creds from browser data, and also an APT group, APT31, are using a Python compiled binary to carry this out. So whether threat actors are using open source tools that are easily accessible and free, or whether they're buying and using info stealers like Redline, both need to be ingressed onto the target host and then executed by an unsuspecting user for those threat actors to capture credentials.
You would imagine that would be setting up, well, you would like to hope that would set off pretty much every alarm bell going though, right? You know, once you see that those sorts of tools being ingressed. But obviously this is a growing problem. And I always used to think of like saving passwords in browsers. It's just one of those things you really shouldn't do. Like I've kind of known that for a very, very long time. Even before I came into this particular job, like we knew that was a bad idea. You know, use password managers, things like that instead. What did the case study that we identified in the report, what did that kind of show?
Yeah, so the case study was kind of an in-depth look into a customer incident that we investigated. So it was a customer based in the manufacturing sector, and we saw Luma C2, the info stealer, being used against that customer. And from what we saw, it was likely that a drive-by download was the cause of Luma Stealer becoming present on that host. And that was initiated when a user visited a compromised domain and then was redirected to a malicious site that downloaded Luma. So we saw within that event that a password was required within the file that was downloaded to extract the content. And then once the file was extracted and executed, it then connected to an external IP address and made requests to an attacker domain. And that's likely the process by which the data was exfiltrated. The malicious file that we saw downloaded had gained a valid signature, meaning that it wasn't immediately blocked. So when you said, Chris, that things, alarm bells should be firing everywhere, the sophistication of these tools is getting around those alerts. By us kind of noticing this and responding quickly, it meant that our customer is able to immediately remediate that attack and stop the credentials being used maliciously. So it's a happy ending to this one.
One happy ending, but of course there's going to be lots of other customers, not customers, but lots of other organizations who, you know, won't be as fortunate because of these advanced or more, I guess, sophisticated ways of getting credentials as opposed to your usual brute forcing techniques and things of that nature. One for both of you, what methods can we advise to listeners in hardening their controls for sort of managing credentials in general. So obviously you shouldn't be storing them in browsers, but what can we do?
Yeah, so as well as not storing in browsers, you can use offload password managers, like you mentioned. Don't reuse credentials across multiple accounts and enforce MFA. So that's you kind of hardening around the actual credentials. And then as a user, I guess. And then if you are a network defender, you can do things like implementing group policies to restrict the execution of unknown applications. If you're working on Windows, you can restrict the use of the command terminal. So principle of least privilege in that respect. If a threat actor can't access terminal, then they can't ingress those tools that we mentioned before. So those are a couple of things for network defenders.
Great. No, that's some really good advice. Go on, Fergal.
Yeah, just that the principle of least privilege is a really good way to like mitigate any damage done if attackers do successfully gain network access. I often think that, yeah, in these instances, the weakest link is the human one. Education plays a really important role here, and it's our job as cybersecurity practitioners to inform and enhance cybersecurity posture wherever possible. So I think that a lot of it should be top down, and users need to understand that the importance of password security and the associated risks that come with poor management of credentials as well.
Yeah, it has to be mandated by the company, I would say. Mm-hmm. If you give users the option, then, you know, and just say, well, we think you shouldn't do this, they'll just go ahead and do it. So things like using your work email to log into some third-party mm-hmm. application or sign up to it, just don't do it.
Yeah,
just don't do it. There's no need. And it should be something that companies should mandate. Do not do this because it can present such an enormous risk. Not just yourself, but obviously your employer. So, yeah. Awesome. Let's move on to the next topic. I didn't want to spend too much time on this, obviously, because we've the last couple of episodes of Shadow Talk we've dedicated to Lockbit. But just to quickly touch upon any developments that we've seen related to Lockbit and ransomware in general in the last week. So, you know, over to you, Fergal. What have you seen?
So, very interestingly, Operation Kronos, the takedown operation behind Lockbit, while it seemed like an initial success, they sprung up again immediately in a new incarnation as Lockbit 3.0. Very recently, they claimed, I believe it was Fulton County in Georgia, and they also claimed that they had documents as part of the ransom pertaining to the Donald Trump case, and that the only reason that the FBI came after them at this point was to cover their tracks regarding this. However, they reported on their website that the ransom was paid in full by Fulton County when, funnily enough, Fulton County themselves denied doing so. So it would appear that they are trying to blag their way through to essentially their competence to try and convey that they are still doing the job that they're doing. And it would appear that they're actually quite a lot weaker. And it will be interesting to pay attention to this in the next few weeks to see if the credibility wanes regarding any other ransomware attacks as well. If this will influence any organization's decisions whether or not to pay the ransom or to just actually try and sit it out. Because at the end of the day, if it's a bluff, well, they're not going to waste any money on that, are they? So
anecdotally. I saw something on LinkedIn earlier that I shared actually, and it was saying that it was a rather more positive view on ransomware. This chap was essentially alluding that ransomware is kind of something that is on the decline. Organizations are much less willing to actually pay at the moment. I'm not sure I agreed with everything that was being said in this, but I thought it was an interesting take nonetheless. And that the main kind of driver behind paying ransoms is the data breach now. It's not the encryption of assets because, you know, a lot of the time things can be restored via backups, as we all know. And I'd like to hope organizations are getting better at understanding that and testing these backups, making sure they're in place. But I did think that was an interesting way of looking at it. You know, it's the data exfiltration that is really driving the payment of these ransoms. So, yeah. I mean, not surprising that Lockbit would say something that potentially isn't true on their website.
It's common practice.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, anything that surprised you about this, Kim, at all? Like the quickness in which they were able to show resilience, I guess? Or is it as you would have expected?
Yeah, not really. I think we've seen groups kind of bounce back quickly, reemerge and rebrand. I was just going to talk quickly about Alf V, because it's been a quite interesting development there in the last couple of days, and it's kind of on the same theme of law enforcement takedowns. So obviously we know they were subject to some law enforcement action not so long ago. I don't think it was as comprehensive as the Lockbit takedown, but still had an impact nonetheless. But similarly, the group quickly re-established its data leak site and has been hitting headlines recently for its involvement in the cyber attack against Change Healthcare platform owned by Optum. But in the last couple of days, the group's data leak site has been displaying an FBI flash page. So we all kind of assumed that law enforcement had just jumped back on the new domain, but then it's now come to light that Alfie themselves probably have taken all their infrastructure offline, and it's possibly part of an exit scam, which I thought was interesting, because I don't think we haven't seen one of those in a while. And then the reporting was basically that an affiliate of Alfie, the one that was responsible for the Change Healthcare attack, was blocked out of the deal by the main group, and they stole the $22 million ransom that Optum allegedly paid. That's not confirmed. And the group cited that the law enforcement pressure had screwed them over, and they're reportedly selling their malware source code for $5 million. So trying to make the big bucks, it seems like, to swan off into the sunshine or potentially use it to develop some other capability.
Wow, like an episode of Coronation Street, this, isn't it? You know, more twists and turns and I don't know what. Blimey. I mean, they'll return in some fashion, won't they? They don't stay gone forever. I mean, that's what I would do if I was a cyber criminal. If you'd made those kind of profits, you would just run off into the sunshine. But then,
there's
more money to be had, apparently.
If you can't leave Russia, then what are you going to do with all your 27 million?
Yeah, I'm sure there's some sunshiny parts of Russia.
I think there's some nice beaches.
Of course, yeah.
Some islands.
There we go. Awesome. Wow. Well, there you have it. We'll have to keep our eyes looking out for what's next for Alpha V. Let's move to the last topic for today. That's around the National Institute of Standard and Technology, which listeners will probably more commonly know them as NIST. They have released an update to their cybersecurity framework, the often referenced set of guidelines and best practices for cybersecurity strategy. And this is the first refresh since the guidance document was originally issued in 2014. So, Kim, could you provide just a brief overview of NIST and what the new framework has suggested organizations start doing?
Yeah, so NIST is part of the US Department of Commerce, and its mission is to promote US innovation and industrial competitiveness by advancing measurement science, standards, and technology in ways that enhance economic security and improve quality of life. I've copied that directly off their website.
Fair enough.
So I think that says it better than I ever could. And then the new framework has built on the previous framework. So the previous framework had like five pillars. So identify, protect, detect, respond, and recover. And the new one has added a sixth function, which is called govern. Govern is about giving greater executive and board oversight into cyber threats, now that cyber threats are affecting all organizations everywhere, and it should be top of every board or executive member's agenda. And then coupled with that, the previous guidelines framework were mostly targeted towards critical infrastructure organizations, so like banks, energy sector, oil and gas. But these new guidelines, new framework is expanding the best practice to all organizations everywhere, meaning that these organizations will need to consider reevaluating existing setups, identifying gaps, and coming up with plans to remediate those.
I see. So it's a little more all-encompassing to a broader range of organizations than perhaps the original 2014 framework might have been.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on generally on like best practice frameworks like this? Is this something that organizations like really actually attain to achieve? Or yeah, I guess what I'm asking is the frameworks that they put out and suggest to organizations, is it actually achievable? Or is it a little kind of, you know, optimistic pie in the sky? What's your thoughts generally?
I think it's quite achievable. If you look at the different functions or the pillars, whatever you want to call them, like identify, protect, detect, respond and recover, that should be within every organization's plan to respond to cyber attacks. You know, identify the threats, try and protect your network from the threats, like stop an attack happening in the first place. But then if it does happen, like pick it up quickly, respond to it quickly, and have a recovery plan in place. So I think they're really, really good guidelines for organizations. It kind of sets a standard. That's what it's there to do. But it's up to individual businesses to actually make that guidance actionable. And that's going to depend on size of security teams, how overworked they are, whether there's the appetite within the board to spend time, you know, reevaluating all of their setups and changing things around. So I do think it is an achievable one, but it is still only guidance. So whether people actually follow it is another matter.
Yes. And I think you hit the nail on the head there when you were talking about senior management approval. Just anything in this space, you just can't get done unless you have that sign off from your executive, your board level, to go and implement those changes that will have, you know, a good impact on your resilience to these common threats that we talk about on the podcast all the time. Good stuff. All right. I think that's everything we want to cover this week. So I'll end the podcast here. Just like to take this opportunity to say, you know, if you do find the insights we talk about, you know, insightful, give us a like, a subscribe on your podcasting platform, tell a friend. Always trying to reach new listeners, so that always really helps. Otherwise, stay safe and we'll see you next week.